Get Lit.
Welcome back to Get Lit, the literary podcast where we discuss famous works of literature and the authors who wrote them. I'm your host, Steph Sfars, joined here by my co-host,
John Stricker.
And we are back together again. We've had a lot of various separations over the last several episodes, so it's fun to be recording together in the room. But we do sincerely hope all of you enjoyed last week's episode with our very special guest, Jamie Jones. It was a really fascinating conversation to be able to have, and I'm so excited to be able to promote her book and be able to have that, you know, small reunion, which was just such a delight. So hopefully you all left inspired to go read some version of environmental literature and or, of course, check out Rendered Obsolete.
Stephanie, I had the pleasure of listening to the episode this week, and I'll tell you, it was a whale of a good time. And I think that anyone who hasn't had a chance to listen to the episode, it is unique for us to be able to talk to our author in real time because they're usually dead. And it's hard then, as one does, of talking to the dead. Maybe we'll find a medium one of these days and channel F. Scott Fitzgerald or like Arthur Conan Doyle, who actually was maybe more interested in the mediums themselves. But it was just so great, the back and forth that you and Jamie could have. It definitely shed light, not only on the book itself, but also on the energy transition that she was trying to capture. Just super fascinating. I don't think that many people read Moby Dick with that lens. And hopefully it's the start of maybe a change.
Yes, I think there's a lot of value in studying the environment through a humanities lens. Of course, it's deeply important to be able to do that through a scientific lens, especially as we look at our own version of the energy crisis presently and what the future looks like. But I think being able to approach it from all angles brings a lot of value to the conversation as a whole. So I'm really glad that we could be part of that conversation. And, you know, if you enjoyed that episode, please go ahead and share it with friends or family members. It's again, kind of a different twist on the environmental conversation. And it's also a little different than our typical episode. So for those of you that have friends and family members who would listen to Get Lit, except for they don't care about literature or something.
Or John, right? Like that's really the thing keeping them from listening is the color commentary. So you have a good episode to just focus on the content.
It's definitely a different angle or approach, although I don't know that we'll be getting into interview podcasting anytime soon. It certainly is a pleasure to shake things up and be able to listen and hear the ideas and research of Jamie and all of her incredible work. So it was a delight, but I'm very glad that you are also back so we can talk about this week's subject, who will actually, I think, tie together quite a few of the threads of the last couple episodes, both some of the conversation that I had with Jamie and when we featured Sinclair Lewis and Main Street. This is another author that's been on my list for quite a while. But again, this sort of same idea, small town commentaries and evaluation of American life as it started to shift. So I'm very excited to be profiling Sherwood Anderson for all of you today.
Stephanie, I don't know much about Sherwood Anderson, but it kind of sounds like maybe he would start like a paint and lumber company. So that's how much I know about him, which is negative something, I guess, if you count that. But I do have something of value to bring to the table right now, and that's that I do have a news article if you'd like to hear about it.
I would love to start out with that. We do need an update. We've been without one. And we do need it.
We do. And the world of literature, as always, is abuzz with news. And there was just recently an editorial in The Guardian. Let me read you the title. The Guardian View on YA Literature, An Adventure for Teenagers, A Comfort Blanket for Adults.
Okay.
What do you think about that characterization?
Well, I mean, I reread, like, I have comfort books. I have all kinds of stuff. I would absolutely agree with that assessment.
But I think it kind of presupposes that YA novels can only be comfort blankets for adults rather than maybe beneficial in their own right. So I'm interested to see after I explain the article, whether or not you still kind of think that covered blanket is a worthy descriptor. So the subtitle is a new survey revealing that 3/4 of readers of books for teens are over 18 has one message. Read anything you like, but read. I liked that.
Yes.
I think it's kind of true. I think we all have like maybe a canon in our head that we feel we should read that maybe doesn't often coincide with what we want to read. And I think that if that's you, know that you're in good company, that you can read the books you want to read and not have to sort of subscribe to some perfect canon. So the beginning of the article sort of harkens back to the idea of teenager coming into existence, which they profile as being a pretty new development, only about 80 years, and kind of how markets have shifted such that they go after the teenager as a demographic. So I thought that was interesting, that you can't have YA literature until you understand that YA is a stage of life, right? That young adults are distinct from children and are distinct from adults, but that there's some transitional zone where you're a young adult. So anyhow, I thought that was an interesting kind of foundation for this article. And in the research that they were profiling, 74% of YA readers were over 18. 28% were over 28. Stephanie, that sentence made me feel very old, in that they have chosen an arbitrary like age over which, like, can you believe they still read YA and it is now younger than us? So anyhow, we are firmly in the adult camp. So the breakdown was a third of readers are aged between 18 and 22, and another third are between 23 and 34. So I think it kind of shows that there's a staying power to this medium, and they unsurprisingly specifically mention Harry Potter as one of the events over which the YA industry kind of exploded, and they noted it's actually contracting right now from its heyday, which was around that Harry Potter boom. But they also profiled some like current YA novels that are getting a lot of attention, or at least more current YA novels. They were talking about The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, which came out as both an adult version and a teenage version, which I think is interesting. I don't think I knew that about the book, but no, there's two versions. Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that is.
It reminds me of when I was a child, Stephanie. I might have told this story before. I had this copy of Moby Dick and Treasure Island and a bunch of other like literary classics with the capitalist C you can think of, all dead white author men. And I was getting through these books really quickly and just turning them around. I'm like, what's so hard about like War and Peace? I don't get it. I read it and I understood it all, and I'm only 12. And I go back later to realize I'm reading an abridged version for children, and I didn't know that thing existed. And so here I am, like, patting myself on the back as a young adult, as like the next savant in literature. When in reality, I am reading exactly at my grade level. So I just thought that was a funny precocious moment, or anti-precocious moment.
It gave you the complex, and that's okay. And we're seeing the benefits of that today.
Right. The rest of my life is making up for that moment. So the rest of the article sort of searches for a reason why this kind of work is appealing to the quote-unquote older demographics. But I think that part of the article is largely speculative, and I think our guess is as good as the editorial. And like coming back to that idea of it being a blanket, I think that if we don't stigmatize the fact that safety blankets are reasonable to want and have, I think then I am comfortable with that as a descriptor for why more mature audiences read YA novels, and that something familiar, as long as it still has bones worth considering, you shouldn't discount it just because it can also be understood and may have even been targeted for the young adult.
I mean, I don't disagree with that. I agree with the fact that, yes, we should let, just enjoy whatever kind of literature you want, enjoy whatever kind of books you want. But I don't know. I guess I've always sort of seen books as being a place to go for comfort. So I don't know that I'm quite as put off by that as like a coddling title in that capacity, where I've always sort of turned to books as a source of wisdom or comfort and joy. So I guess I'll always see books as a security or, comfort blanket as a positive thing rather than a negative. But regardless, I think I absolutely support the celebration of everyone's novel choices as what they should be able to read.
You definitely didn't attack it and pat yourself on the back for reading the abridged children's version. So we're coming at this from very different angles,
Stephanie. I guess so. I do remember having, or it was in my sixth grade teacher's classroom, she had an abridged or a shorter version of The Fall of the House of Usher. So that was my exposure to Fall of the House of Usher, was this abridged, and The Cask of Amontillado as well.
Really?
It was basically, I think it was just the Edgar Allan Poe short stories. So I read all of those abridged, or, I remember very specific pictures. They were partially illustrated as well. So I think that was my thing. And then, when I got to high school or whenever I read them again next, it was sort of oh, I remember this story in the back of my head. But yeah, it took a while to figure out. I think if they were, I guess I didn't have such a hard time being upset that they weren't abridged classics to begin with. But
sure. And I think it might even be an interesting exercise now, after reading some of the full short stories, to see how do they make this more palatable for a younger audience? What are they doing to the text such that they feel that it is
more appropriate
towards a young adult?
Yeah. Well,
the idea of Moby Dick just straight up being children's literature in the past that you discussed last episode, I'm sure that the goalposts have moved over time.
Yeah, just slightly down a couple pegs or notches. I will say that I do have many wonderful people in my life that have babies, less than 1 year old babies, or, less than a year and a half. And I have purchased many a copy of Moby Dick as a board book, Pride and Prejudice as a board book, Little Women, Anne of Green Gables, the stories of Edgar Allan Poe. So board book versions of these do exist. And I think that's just delightful. I think everybody should grow up reading Moby Dick as a board book, and then as an abridged book, and then as the full book version, and all kinds of things like that.
You can almost grow with the text.
Isn't that so cool? And they're also just really cute. They're really cute books. I would highly recommend checking out those board books. They're super fun.
You're just a sucker for illustrations, Stephanie.
Yeah, I just love a children's book. I'm so happy to sit down and read a children's book. But yeah, regardless of what version of a book you get, I do hope everybody is able to find some version that speaks to them, be it a picture book version of Moby Dick or the full thing. All are valid ways to approach A Great White Whale or similar.
Oh, I agree.
Well, the author that we are going to be profiling doesn't necessarily have children's books in his arsenal, but I think we'll provide some interesting context to American literature nonetheless. So we are actually going to be staying in the Midwest, so we don't have very far to travel, but we will be heading on over to Ohio. So go ahead, for John and I, that's just a road trip, but for everybody, wherever you're listening from, feel free to grab your train ticket, plane ticket, seatbelt, et cetera, et cetera. And we will head on over to learn more about Sherwood Anderson. Sherwood Anderson was born in Camden, Ohio on September 13th, 1876, which makes him both a Midwestern author and a Virgo, which John and I have outsized positive responses to, or I do anyway. But that puts him squarely in between you and I on the birthday agenda.
It's the same day as my grandmother.
That is, yes, that's true. So according to famousbirthdays.com, he is the fourth most popular person with the first name Sherwood, except I'd literally never heard of the other three. So I'm just going to say, to me, he's the most popular person with the first name Sherwood, and we'll go from there.
I'm good with that.
He is the 25th most popular author born on September 13th, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
The other authors on this list include Roald Dahl, who we have done, and then Aquilino Ribeiro. He is a Portuguese Nobel Prize winner. That's and cool. Cleo Wade, who's a contemporary poet. I have one of her books of poetry.
Nice. That's a pretty diverse list.
Yeah, it was cool. He's also the 45th most popular person born in 1876. And I don't know, maybe it's just because I am situated pretty squarely in the world of literature, but that means there were a lot of famous people born in 1876, and a lot of them, again, I hadn't heard of before. I'm sure Sherwin Anderson might have made it higher if I'd been doing that organization, but other famous people born that year include Mata Hari, the famous dancer / spy, Jack London, Gitlet alumni.
Yeah.
Zeke Kala Shah, Gitlet alumni, and Bess Houdini, just for color.
Nice.
Right. So his parents are Erwin McLean Anderson and Emma Jane Smith, and Sherwood is their third child. But unfortunately, due to a variety of circumstances after Sherwood was born, the family has to move because their father's small business had failed.
Oh.
So ultimately, they settle in Clyde, which is a small Ohio town that will factor into a lot of his work later on in life. But for those that are curious or unfamiliar with Ohio's landscape, it's between Cleveland and Toledo on the kind of northern border, pretty close to the lake. So it's definitely on our way. If we were to drive from here to Pennsylvania, we would probably drive through Clyde, which is deeply unhelpful for anyone who doesn't immediately live in the Chicagoland area, but I did my best.
No, I think if anything, we're giving people a roadmap so they can come visit us one of these days.
Oh, that's true. That's fair. So the financial struggles of the family continue, unfortunately. And so Anderson has kind of an intermittent experience with school. He does a lot of different jobs throughout the course of his childhood to help support the family. But he works as a newsboy and as a house painter, as a farmhand, as a racetrack helper. It's unclear to me what exactly that meant, if he was like helping gamble or like if he was taking care of the horses or maintaining the facility or maybe all of the above. But regardless, those were just some of the jobs that he held. He had so many jobs that he was nicknamed Jobby as a child, which feels deeply unoriginal, but gave him that nickname nonetheless.
It is a little bit on the nose, isn't it?
Yes.
I think in a small town, like, it lends itself to you being able to do something like this. My dad grew up in a smaller town, and one of the things that he did was help maintain the racetrack, actually, Stephanie. Except it was for cars rather than horses. But, like, there's just space to do that, as well as maybe not another person tasked with doing it if your town is small enough. So anyhow, the list of jobs is not far off from what my dad has said that he did in his small town.
There you go. I guess, you know, they say that you don't have as many opportunities in small towns, but maybe that's just not true.
Right. And now his nickname was Bobby, but that's for other reasons instead of okay. Jobby. His name's Robert. Because
that's, his name was Robert.
That's yeah. the reason.
But I guess falls into the same vein as like not necessarily original.
Yeah.
If that's the part of it. So in 1896, Anderson leaves for Chicago. His brother Carl was living in Chicago at the time, and he works doing manual labor. I think this was just, again, to kind of get out. He doesn't have finished schooling in any capacity, so he winds up staying there until he enrolls in service in Cuba during the Spanish-American War. I actually found very little information about his time in the war. So I guess he either just chose not to write about it or talk about it, or I didn't research particularly well. But regardless, he did serve in the military there for a time during the Spanish-American War.
It's a weird war anyway, Stephanie. I mean, it's forged mostly under, like, imperialist strategies, under, like, the prompting of newspaper interests. So there's not a huge amount of, like, fervor after the main goes for the war, really. So, like, anyway, I'm not surprised that it didn't feature prominently in the biographies that you were looking at.
Great. Thank you for getting me off the hook for that. So after the war, he follows his brother again. His brother is actually working as an artist for the Crowell Publishing Company, which is in Springfield, Ohio. So he jumps back to Ohio. There'll be a lot of geographic jumps, just so we're all aware. But now he's currently in Springfield, Ohio, where he attends Wittenberg Academy for about a year. He does not finish there, but his mother dies when he's 19. I think she got like tuberculosis or something. And he moves back to Chicago to work in advertising. The advertising manager at Crowell actually is the one who gets him a job in Chicago as a copywriter. So I thought, again, that's kind of a nice connection for his family to have. And he does really, really well as a copywriter, which might be unsurprising knowing where his career will eventually take him.
Sure.
In 1904, he marries a woman named Cornelia Lane, and they have three children together pretty quickly after this. Robert, so there you go, Robert factors back in. John, another name that we're very familiar with. Can you guess the third name?
Michael.
Nope.
Daniel.
Try another family members of yours.
Wait, really?
Yeah, it's Marion.
No.
Yeah.
Okay, listeners, my father's name is Robert, my mother's name is Marion, and I'm John. So this is very strange. Okay, they're all well, good, they call solid names.
Yeah, the spellings are different, though. They've spelled John the correct way in this one. Just kidding. His daughter is called Mimi. That's her nickname.
So. That's actually really cute.
I thought so. So he and the family move back to Ohio, and he starts to work as a businessman. He writes fiction work in his spare time, but he's working doing this kind of like mail order paint manufacturing situation. Again, just sort of seemed like a strange job, but it added to his list. So he's working in Elyria, Ohio at the time when he very abruptly leaves the office in 1912. He is gone for 4 days and winds up in Cleveland, where he is very distraught and very disheveled. So people consider this, and he sort of writes about it as a psychotic break in some capacity. But it's a very, I would imagine, strange 4 or 5 days to have known him or been a family member of his.
That's scary. It kind of is like reminiscent of the Agatha Christie missing days.
It is, except afterwards, things don't necessarily go back to normal because he winds up leaving his wife and children for a fresh start in Chicago.
Whoa.
And yeah, so that's a bit of a sudden jump.
How can you get rid of John, Robert, and Marion? You're leaving us behind.
Yeah. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
It seems at some point that he does make amends because his son Robert will factor later into the episode. So I don't know, again, exactly what happened, but something couldn't have been that bad because he has some form of relationship with them as adults.
That's good, at least.
Anyway, he starts to get to know a lot of the literary Renaissance figures in Chicago, including Carl Sandburg, Ben Hecht, who I get to talk about every time I do a Newbery tour because we have one of Ben Hecht's Oscars at the Newbery. So if you're interested in checking out an Oscar statuette, you are welcome to do it and know that it is Ben Hecht's and he was a screenwriter. And Floyd Dell, who was actually a member of the Provincetown Players. So I was delighted by that connection to no one's shock or amazement.
Yeah. And every time like we're bringing them up, it's like a more and more obscure connection because that is not a name I've ever heard of before. And I've listened to a lot of your talk on the Provincetown Players.
Sorry. Well, we can do an episode on him because he has an interesting life as well.
Cool.
but they all kind of help and encourage him to publish and work on his writing. And he publishes two autobiographical novels, one called Windy McPherson's Son in 1917, and another called Marching Men in 1918. But he also publishes his short stories in various magazines around town, including the Little Review and the Poetry Magazine, but also another Provincetown Player connection.
There you go.
He publishes in The Masses as well, which is a really important kind of bohemian publication that lots of Provincetown Players were involved with. So again, I got very excited to read about that.
Very cool. It sounds like he's really tapping into the, as you said before, the who's who of the literary elite of Chicago in the time.
Definitely. So in 1914, he officially divorces his wife. He had, again, just kind of up and left. And he marries a woman named Tennessee Mitchell. She's a dance and piano teacher and a sculptor. So that happens. And then he publishes, a few years later, a collection of poetry called Mid-American Chants in 1918. And he starts again, you can kind of see that throughout this, he's experimenting with a variety of forms. He's written short stories, articles, novels, poetry, and kind of flip-flops around the place, which I'm guessing has a lot to do with the people that he's getting to know and meet. Carl Sandburg is a poet. Floyd Dell writes a lot of nonfiction, but also he dabbles in plays, so he's getting a lot of exposure.
Plus, variety is the spice of life. So, I mean,
that will be true in many ways, not just in genre. So in 1915, he starts to write a series of short stories that will eventually be published in 1919 as Winesburg, Ohio. That's the name of the piece. This is the one that he is most famous for, and this is the one that's sitting on my shelf. This is what I want to put in conversation with Our Town and Main Street. It fits this very interesting, and maybe like Spoon River Anthology or something, but all of these have a very similar flair and vibe, investigating small town American life in the same time period. Maybe we can do just like a fun lesson or like an 8-week course about like literature like this. And we can put all of these in one room together and see what happens.
Yeah. And having just seen your student's production of Big Fish, I wonder if you don't have a penchant for stories that glorify a quiet, like bucolic life in a small town. Like,
could be, but his perspective, and from my understanding, the Main Street perspective of Sinclair Lewis, are also critical of this, which I think holds value to it as well.
Interesting. Okay, I'll reserve further analysis until I finish those two novels.
Great. So we will not be hearing from you again on the subject.
That's correct.
Okay, great. So Anderson is influenced by a lot of the modernist writers, and the opening chapter of this book is called The Book of the Grotesque, and he makes a lot of philosophical claims about human nature. He talks about the limits of humans and our ability to reflect on our own lives and perceive actual understanding of the world. So it isn't necessarily, I guess, idyllic. It's not a soft look at this, but rather kind of explores our own limits of who we are as people and the way that we have shaped and think about the world, which I think is interesting. Again, because both of these perspectives, I think, are so incredibly important in understanding our, I guess, American culture in a lot of ways, this small town kind of life and what that means.
Right. And it sounds almost at odds with like an Enlightenment principle where, you know, you elevate the rational and the intellectual, and instead you humor the baser animal nature of humans, right? Like when you're talking about like the foundational like philosophy for America, it hits on the Enlightenment, which is like an elevation of the rational and intellectual over some of the other kind of forces that fight against human nature. And it sounds like this might be indulging those kind of forces a bit more.
Yeah, I think he might use that as an interrogation. Should we be feeling these kind of romanticizations of small town life, or do we interrogate them in this way? Where's the balance? What is the, I guess, philosophy that we can look at? So I think that's a fair tool to assess that he might use in trying to pick apart what it means to be an American in small town America at the time.
Interesting.
Right. And so a lot of these influences, of course, come from the writers that he's around, but in particular, Gertrude Stein. He has the privilege, I guess, of traveling a lot, or, you know, kind of this restlessness about him. He visits London and Paris. And of course, while he's in Paris in the 1920s, you can guess who he comes across, not only Gertrude Stein, but also Ernest Hemingway and William Faulkner and things like that. He helps them launch their careers. Although he's not hugely famous, he's solidly put away into American culture where he can help other writers. And in this capacity, it was both Faulkner and Hemingway that benefited from his guidance and mentorship.
Lucky them.
Yes. Well, that also is relatively short-lived. He is definitely a very interesting career, but he wins the first Dial Award for Distinguished Service to American Letters in 1922.
Cool.
He gets $2,000 as a result of this prize, in addition to, you know, the glory of the title. And this helps him launch a successful lecture career as well. So he starts to travel. And then throughout the course of the early 1920s, he'll write three more novels and two short story collections, one called The Triumph of the Egg, which I know absolutely nothing about. So I thought we should play a little game. And I would like, John, for you to tell me, without knowing anything, what if you just heard the title, The Triumph of the Egg, what do you think it would be about?
I think it would be a long dissertation on the knock-knock joke about which came first, and it would be a defense of the position of the egg in the knock-knock joke.
Okay. That's a fair, that would be a fair, and I think a worthy thing of reading.
I think so. It clearly came first, Stephanie.
Okay, that's fair. You know, I won't argue, I will read the work.
Yeah, sure would agree to me.
I thought it might be a fun interpretation of, like, the other half of Humpty Dumpty. Like, what happened after? He triumphs, actually. They did actually put him back together again.
Oh, yes.
Which, actually, now that I'm reading these notes over, the next collection of short stories that he wrote was Horses and Men in 1923. So I'm wondering if that's just a very strange coincidence, or if both of these things are about Humpty Dumpty, and I'm just, again, didn't get deep enough into the research to pick that out.
Either way, I think you get the point.
Great. Well, he was, as you can tell, very restless, didn't stay in one place for very long. So he actually divorces Tennessee.
That is not surprising. No, but this last part is, like, how can you be a serial monogamist and continue to, like, just go through different, like, marriages like that?
It will happen four times over the course of this episode, so sorry.
Thank you for whispering. I will adjust no my problem. Expectations.
Anytime. I didn't want to, like, spoil it, so hopefully listeners weren't able to hear that when they got to this part of the episode.
They definitely didn't. Good job being stealthy.
No, good. Thanks. So he marries a woman named Elizabeth Prawl in 1924. She's a bookseller, actually. She has graduated from the University of Michigan, makes her own career, which, you know, good for her. Mm-hmm. And then the following year, he publishes another work called Dark Laughter. Now, there was some kind of interesting overlap in his career at this point. It seems like he is now on a downtrend, but this is kind of this pivotal moment in his life where this happens. So in 1925, Vanity Fair describes him as the country's most distinctive novelist. Then H.L. Mencken praises Dark Laughter as a profound novel, but his overall reputation as a writer is on the decline. Many of the authors that he helped mentor, including Hemingway and Fitzgerald, have overtaken him. And Hemingway actually parodies Anderson's style of writing in his work, The Torrents of Spring. So he is sort of, it was kind of, in my opinion, as I was doing this, like a sad twist. And it wasn't entirely clear to me why that happened.
Yeah, it's almost like no good deed goes unpunished. Thanks a lot, Mr. Hemingway.
Yeah. So he bounces around throughout the course of this period. He lives in New York City for a while. He lives in Fairhope, Alabama, New Orleans, Reno, Nevada. He literally jumps all around the country as an exposed to lots of different ways of living, which again will factor into his works as he continues to evaluate and write about the people of America at this time and what was going on during this time period. He really gets excited, though. He travels to Virginia, vacations in southwestern Virginia, everyone's favorite vacation spot. And 1926, he has made some money from Dark Laughter because it has done reasonably well. And he buys and builds a house there in this area called Ripshin, which is named after the creek that runs through the property. It's near Troutdale, which is the name of a town in Virginia.
No, you're making things up it's now.
What?
Troutville next to Ripton.
Yeah, they're all the same. It's in the western corner of the state. So if you were to go look this up today, it's kind of in, like, you know how West Virginia, I don't know, what's the shape? Maybe like a bird head? Like it's got the beak facing west and like sort of the big head part that's on the eastern side.
I've never tried to like fit the shape into something, but yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, the bird's head. Okay.
Anyway, so it's like in the beak.
Oh.
That's where we are.
That's so strange. Like, because it's like directly wedged between like Pennsylvania and Ohio.
Yes.
Cool.
And that seemed to be where he felt very comfortable. So this property still exists today. It looks very pretty. I was looking at pictures of it and it's a very nice stone. It's a very lovely building. And the natural next step, of course, John, you know, when you build a house in West Virginia, this is my take on if you give a mouse a cookie. If you build a house in Virginia, you need to buy two newspapers to go with it.
I mean, that is the only logical thing to do.
Right. So he buys the Smith Country News and the Marion Democrat. Again, same name as his daughter, but it's unrelated. And he starts to write under this sort of alter ego and pseudonym called Buck Fever. That's the name of this pseudonym. Oof. And he reports on all of the kind of local events and things like that that are happening in these towns. He writes about farmers. He writes about Civil War veterans. He writes about religion, court trials, the social life in the town. And this is what I thought was kind of interesting. So maybe you could tell by the name, but the Marion Democrat is a very staunchly Democratic newspaper. But the Smith County News is actually a Republican publication. So again, I just thought that was so weird. He buys both of these newspapers. They're on opposite ends of the political spectrum. And he just owns and runs them. I can't decide if that would be like actually a really good thing. And he'd need to kind of be partisan or, you know, could have influenced positively some of these things. Or if it was just like completely deranged and unhinged for him to own two of these different politically minded papers.
I mean, I guess ideologically it's like a conflict. But money wise, it seems to be like a really solid business model. You don't have any overlap or very little overlap in your newspaper consumers.
That's true. And you'll sell them either way. Well, anyway, he becomes kind of like this local celebrity. People really know him. He really entrenches himself into the town. And he is able to really connect different people across these, I guess, different political ideas. In November of 1930, here's another fun name that I didn't make up, but it definitely sounds like it. In 1930, he introduces Stringfellow Barr.
No.
That is a human's name.
Really?
Yep.
I want him to be the inventor of the cheese stick for some reason.
Oh, he is not. He's a historian. Okay. So you might actually like enjoy his work. So anyway, he introduces Stringfellow Bar and John Crow Ransom, which is also not really real.
No.
At a Richmond debate on industrialism versus agrarianism. You know, Stephanie, the riveting debate that we're having.
It's never been more clear that you did the research through AI than just now.
Oh, yeah. None of these author bios are real. I just say, write me a biography of Sherwood Anderson. Go. Honestly, I've never used an AI generator. Like, I haven't actually been to any of the websites before, just sort of on like stubborn principle. So I don't even know that if you asked me to do it, that I would know what to do.
I don't really know either, to be honest with you.
Or, right? Like how to refine it? I don't know. I guess I can go ask my students.
Yeah.
Anywho.
I interrupted. What are they debating? You're Mr. String Cheese and Crow Man?
Oh. industrialism versus agrarianism.
Oh, sure.
So the conflicts again at the time, right?
It is, yeah.
So people actually wound up apparently liking Anderson's opening remarks more so than the actual debate itself, which I thought was kind of interesting. But this, again, just sort of goes to show the role that he plays in the town, that people really trust him and like him. His office sort of functions as a library, an art gallery in the town. He's always inviting people to come be in it and part of it. And it seems like this is maybe the most positive times that he has in his life. He describes as he's writing, you know, and reflecting about his time here, he says, quote, "I'm closer to life than I've ever been," end quote. Which again, just sort of, I think, reminds us actually kind of distinctly of what the small town life sort of looks like or does. But I think that kind of actually really represents what it is to live in a small town. There isn't a ton of extra, I guess, fluff or accoutrement, I guess, interfering with life in a small town in that way. And so in a lot of ways, even though he critiques and writes about the small town, it seems to really be something that he enjoys himself.
Yeah, but it seems because of all of his wanderlust, maybe he's an observer, and for the first time, he feels maybe integrated in a small town community like I haven't really heard you describe thus far.
That's true. That's true. He definitely, you know, moves around every couple of years and really seems to struggle to find a place to set down roots, so to speak. But this is a place that he really loves, and so much so that he buys a house and invests in newspapers. But this is actually where his son will come back. In 1929, he gives the ownership of the newspapers to his son, Robert. So again, I don't know exactly if that was out of guilt or if it was in the will or if he just had a good relationship with Robert and that made the most sense. But regardless, he transfers that ownership and then he begins a tour of southern factory towns with a woman who lives in his town who works in the industrial program for the WYCA, Young Women's Christian Association, for those who are interested. And I'm guessing that you can see where this is going.
I can. And the fact that she's part of the YWCA, it's almost ironic when I'm thinking about what's happening next.
Right. So to everyone's shock, surprise, and amazement, he divorces Prawl in 1932. Oh. And then the following year, July 6, 1933, he and Eleanor Copenhaver get married. They will stay married until he dies, actually. So this will be the one that works, I suppose.
That's what they say. Fourth time, the one that works.
Fourth time's a charm. But Copenhaver actually seems like a really interesting and cool person. Oh. She's very socially active. And it's because of her activism and kind of work investigating factory conditions and the industrial corridors and things like that, that spur Anderson to produce a lot of critical reports on Americans during the Great Depression, which I think is kind of cool. And they're published as Perhaps Women in 1931. That's the name of one of them. And Puzzled America in 1935.
Hmm. Okay. I guess evocative titles or provocative titles like Perhaps Women could mean a lot of things. I can see why they're looking for something catchy that you'd want to pick up.
Well, how's this for catchy or provocative? He writes another text. This is a novel called Beyond Desire. Mm. He dedicates it to Eleanor. And then later that year actually helps write a play based on Winesburg, Ohio, the collection that he'd written earlier.
Cool.
And then he also writes a very long essay called Hometown, which is also illustrated, that comes out in 1940. So you can, again, kind of see the thread that ties all of his ideas and thoughts together and are pervasive themes in his work. His last novel that he writes comes out in 1936. It's called Kit Brandon, and it tells the tale of the heroine named Kit Brandon. I know that also comes as a shock and surprise, who is a woman from southwestern Virginia, the Beak, as you might say, who gets involved in bootlegging and the illegal production and sale of whiskey, naturally.
I don't know what else you do in that part of the world, quite honestly.
There's probably some really great hiking.
That's true.
Well, maybe that wouldn't make as interesting of a book, but he writes that one. So the end of Anderson's life is also very, very interesting. So I thought I would, I guess, put the whole story in. But he and Elizabeth head over to Panama. They are headed to South America, and it's a cruise that they take, and he starts to experience really painful stomach cramps. Mm. Also, I should say that this gets slightly graphic, so if you're not interested, maybe just like skip ahead 30 seconds. But anyway, he gets these really painful stomach cramps, so they get off in Panama, and they go to the hospital, where his condition worsens. He actually dies a few days later on March 8th, 1941, at the age of 64, so he's not particularly old. And the autopsy later reveals that he had accidentally swallowed a 3-inch long wooden toothpick while he was like eating an hors d'oeuvre. I saw like conflicting, and again, not that this matters at all, but conflicting reports whether it was that he was drinking a martini that had olives in it or just eating an hors d'oeuvre. Regardless, he accidentally swallows a 3-inch long toothpick and it pierces his intestine, which leads to an infection of his inner lining in his abdomen that he eventually dies from.
AI is getting weird, Stephanie. I don't know what prompt you put in, but like, we got to start helping you with your search terms. No, that's truly unbelievable. What
isn't that wild?
Weird way to die.
I know. Well, I also just don't know how you could accidentally swallow a 3-inch toothpick.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, I wanted all three olives at the same time and I didn't want to chew.
Very bizarre. And I'm imagining also very painful. Yeah. I wouldn't, you know, like, ugh, it just all around sounds not like a great situation. But they eventually get his body back stateside. He's buried in Marion, Virginia, which is where his house is, in Round Hill Cemetery. You can go see it today. He has a very simple little rectangular tombstone that is just, I guess it's a headstone, really. It's not really one that sticks out above the ground. I was looking at that. But all told, he experiments with a lot of different types of writing, a lot of different styles of writing, and really helps capture a lot of American culture and society at the time, which again has sort of been where I've been sitting for the last couple of weeks, I think. And so I'm very interested to see how he might factor into conversation with some of the other authors that we featured. But regardless, I think he is one author that often gets ignored, but clearly has done a lot and incorporated himself into the fabric of American literature, and I thought was worth profiling today.
I'm really glad that you brought his legacy to our attention today. I think there are some subjects that are uniquely American, and one of them is this idea of a noble small town, I think. There's not another writing culture that I know of that quite tackles provincial life in the same way. And I think in the same vein as your Thornton Wilders, as your Sinclair Lewis's, capturing this American aesthetic, this American ideal, especially for this time period, was kind of lightning in a bottle, right?
Very true.
And I think our cultural identity is still even today largely shaped by this idea of the small town America.
I think I agree. I think it has a very deep and abiding impact on the way that we see and understand the various parts of our country. Like, you know, we talked a little bit about this last week in my episode with Jamie, but the idea that we kind of chase around this concept of quaintness for a lot of people, especially those of us from like the city or suburbs who feel very removed maybe from this small town life, but it's very different than actually growing up and living in one. And all told, there's a lot of mythos around that if you don't come from a small town. So it is sort of interesting to see how it factors into culture, especially for people who live in the city, versus what it's actually like to live and experience a small town American, I guess, upbringing, for lack of a better word. But regardless, it seems to have captured our understanding of our identity in a huge way. Regardless of where we come from, it plays a big role in our understanding of what that looks like.
And I think maybe for that reason the most, I'm happy to know more about him.
Excellent. Well, we can all pick up a copy of Winesburg, Ohio, or similar, whichever of his texts sounded most interesting to you. Or maybe it's the collection of his newspaper articles that he wrote between those newspapers. But regardless, we hope that you enjoyed learning a little bit more about Sherwood Anderson today. And we look forward to bringing you some more exciting authors in the future as we head into summer. But until we see and hear from you next, thank you, folks, so much for your support of this podcast. And thank you, as always, for keeping it lit.
There's one thing I know that's true. If you want to be